final unabashed propaganda for students, my former students. They've published books on bumblebees, raising local bumblebees, and managing alternative pollinators in sustainable ways so that we can increase the number of pollinators in ways that to help the honeybees out in their situation. And so in all, what the CCD problem has done is increase our awareness of the need to protect and promote the health of all bee pollinators. And I'll just stop there. Thank you.
Please take one quick question.
There's one right there.
I'm sorry, I didn't quite hear the question. You said that there was benefits of the wild bees?
Well, I'm asking if there are benefits, if they're less susceptible to some of these diseases, and if so, has anyone tried breeding some of their prey?
Okay, so I think he's talking about the feral colonies, escapees from beekeepers' equipment that nest in trees and other places like that, whether they might have some characteristics that we could breed into our bees, into the managed population. Is that your question?
While,
yes, all honeybees in the United States are escapees from man-made equipment. They're not native here. Other species of bees, if we could breed those species into the honeybee, into those, see, I'm not following the question, into those traits. Let me just say that we are breeding honeybees for traits that confer resistance to diseases and mites, and that research is well along, and we're doing that.
In that sense, it's important because we're actually examining how a variable in the nest environment itself can affect the immune system of individual bees. So just for some general background, bees collect plant resins that some trees produce to protect budding leaves against parasites and pathogens. And when they collect it, they pack it on their hind legs, on their corbicula where they would pack pollen, and then they bring it back to the hive and spread it around the entire nest cavity, and this is really for feral colonies. They line the tree cavity with a thin layer of propolis, and they usually deposit more at the nest entrance to prevent any other intruders from coming into the nest. It's important to note that the bees don't chemically modify propolis. They do mix wax, and oftentimes there are pollen and other things mixed in with the resin, but it's not different chemically per se. So resin and propolis can be used interchangeably, and I'll likely use them interchangeably in this talk. So there are some implications that this behavior has. One is that foraging for this rather sticky substance is pretty energetically demanding for a bee. It takes the bees quite a long time to collect these resins, and then when they return to the hive, it takes even longer to unload than it would other foraging items. And additionally, it provides no direct individual reward like foraging for nectar would. So in light of this, there are some interesting findings from the bee genome studies that found a reduction in immune-based gene families in honeybees as compared to solitary insects, and they hypothesized that there are some behavioral mechanisms that honeybees use to compensate for this reduction, and we think that resin collection is one of these behaviors. One of these reasons is because the properties of propolis in terms of its antimicrobial activity for human health has been extensively studied, and propolis is active against all sorts of gram-positive bacteria, viruses, and even things like tumor cells. It's also important to note that propolis from different regions varies chemically and can have vastly different activities based on region. Another line of evidence has been done recently through studies with a Swiss wood ant that collects resin and deposits resin globules throughout the nest material, and they found through three studies that nests with resin have overall less microorganisms than colonies without resin, and that the resin actually allows these ants to invest less in their immune system, shown by a reduction in antimicrobial compounds in the hemolymph. And they've also found that individual ants housed with resin under laboratory conditions have increased survival when challenged with experimental pathogens. So my specific question is to determine if resin collection is, in fact, a colony-level mechanism of disease resistance in honeybees. And specifically with this talk, I'm asking if resin collection and resin in the hive affects the immune system of individual honeybees. So for my experimental design, I combined five source colonies that I've indicated here, and then I combined all of those bees, and then I distributed them equally among my 18 experimental colonies that were part of three treatments: Minnesota propolis, Brazilian propolis, or control colonies. I also marked bees that emerged in these source colonies, and then distributed those equally across my experimental colonies. A week later, I collected these 7-day-old marked bees for analysis of their immune system profiles. And then I also collected 7-day-old bees that had emerged in these experimental colonies. So for my treatments, I had, again, the Minnesota propolis and the Brazilian propolis. And I painted the walls of my colonies with propolis extract, and this is to mimic that propolis envelope that you see in the feral colonies. And then for the control, I painted those colonies with the 70% ethanol, which is the solvent for my propolis extract. To analyze the immune systems, I did some work in Jay Evans' lab at the USDA in Beltsville, and basically what I did was I extracted RNA from whole bees using a standard RNA aqueous protocol, and then I generated cDNAs and assay transcript abundances using real-time PCR for several different genes. I used actin as my housekeeping or reference gene, and then the immune genes I looked at were abacin, defensin 1, apidacin, hymenoptacin, and AM eater. And then I also looked at a generic eubacterial 16S gene to assess the general bacterial loads in my colonies. So these immune-related genes that I was looking at, I mostly looked at the antimicrobial peptides, and these are known to be produced in response to infections or the presence of foreign objects in the hemolymph. And it's important to note that a chronic high production of these antimicrobial peptides can actually have a colony-level fitness cost. I did look at one gene involved in the cellular immune defense, and that's the eater gene. And these are also known to increase in response to infection, and they're involved in things like phagocytosis. So in terms of my results so far, I had two genes that had significant findings, and that's hymenoptacin and the eater gene. So this is a graph of results for hymenoptacin, and this is with the 7-day-old source bees. So these were the bees that emerged in the source colonies, and then we immediately put them into these experimental colonies. And on my y-axis, I have the relative expression of hymenoptacin, and that is, again, relative to actin. And on the x-axis, I have my three treatments, the Brazil and Minnesota propolis and the control, and the ends are the number of bees that I sampled for each. And here you can see that the two propolis treatments, those bees produce less hymenoptacin than in the control colonies. So the bees that are in this propolis-rich environment are investing less in their immune system by producing less hymenoptacin. And for the eater gene, again on the y-axis, it's the relative expression, and that's relative to actin. And here all the values are negative because overall, the eater gene had a lower expression than actin. And here you have the Brazilian propolis is significantly different from the control, with less expression of this eater gene, with the Minnesota propolis being an intermediate. So again, at least in the Brazilian propolis, the bees are able to invest less in their immune system by producing less of this eater gene. So It's also important to note that based on that generic eubacterial gene, there were no differences in bacterial loads, and these colonies were not challenged with pathogens at all. So these are changes that we're seeing in baseline levels just due to the environment. But it's important also to note that lab studies indicate that if we do challenge these colonies with pathogens, we might expect to see either greater changes due to propolis or changes in these other genes as well. And one study that suggests is one that we did with the causative agent of American foulbrood, which is a deadly honeybee bacterial pathogen. And we found that propolis, both Brazilian and Minnesota propolis, does effectively inhibit the growth of this bacteria, again in lab cultures. So for future experiments, we will challenge colonies and or caged bees with pathogens. And we'll repeat using higher doses of propolis. And I'm also going to look at the immune profiles of colonies that we have selectively bred for high and low resin collection, and we're really interested to look at this. And just to wrap up some conclusions, again, we found significant differences for two of the immune-related genes, the hymenoptasin and the eater gene, and this is after a relatively short exposure time to this resin-rich environment. And these colonies weren't challenged with pathogens, so again, we're looking at differences in baseline levels just due to the environment. And this is all important for general bee health because a decreased investment in immune function could have potential impact on colony productivity. And again, in the most general sense, this is a really cool finding because we're finding that the nest environment alone is affecting immune expression on honeybees. So with that, I'd just like to say thanks for your time.
We got time for questions, 2 minutes.
So you think the propolis might chemically be suppressing the immune system, which in some ways sounds bad.
No, we don't. The question was, is propolis chemically suppressing the immune system? And we don't think it's an actual suppression of the immune system. We'd have to do some tests where we actually injected those bees with something like E. coli to see if they have an effect. We can't rule it out, but based on studies like the ant systems where they are increasing survival and reducing the pathogens, we think it's a reduction in bacterial loads that's allowing these bees to invest less in their immune system. Well, we didn't find differences here, but that's potentially because we used the whole bee, and so we don't think the bacterial loads in the hemolymph of like the endosymbiotic bacteria would be affected by propolis. So that's one possibility. No, so we, the propolis extracts came from propolis that we extracted from hives. So they sent us propolis, raw propolis from Brazil, and then we extracted that in ethanol. We collected raw propolis from several different Minnesota colonies. So we're actually using the propolis and not the resin.
In your high and low resin colonies, do you find that that alters your foraging
line? No, there's a really small, the question was if the high and low propolis lines affects the overall foraging behavior. We're not, we're sort of in the beginning stages of this breeding program, but the subset of resin foragers is rather low. And not, and bees don't seem to be exclusively resin foragers. They might be exclusively resin foragers for a day, but they seem to switch. And so it doesn't seem to affect the overall foraging level. Thank you.
So division of labor is a fundamental feature of social groups from insects to humans. And it can be defined as a group level pattern whereby different individuals perform different functions or tasks. And it results from individuals specializing performing certain tasks disproportionately relative to others. And social insects are the poster child of division of labor, particularly the eusocial insects, which have been studied quite extensively and we'll learn more during this symposium about the regulatory mechanisms and perhaps even the adaptive significance of divisional labor in new social groups. However, divisional labor is also common in other societies, such as communal and quasi-social.
Well, I'm not the vivacious Marianne Fraser, nor am I the articulate Jim Fraser, who's the neurobiologist and behaviorist on the group. And Marianne Fraser is handling most of the PR and most of the extension, so why am I up here? Well, I am a classical insect toxicologist. I have done a lot of work with pesticides. And I was brought on about a year ago to give some oversight to the pesticide analysis. As is usually the case, there's three supervisors to one technician in the laboratory, Sarah Ashcraft, who is doing a lot of the work with the ecotox, particularly the analysis of the pesticides relative to toxicity. So what is probably the rate-limiting step in doing pesticide analysis, particularly if you want a comprehensive approach, is to find a laboratory that can actually detect things in a way that the EPA will accept and as well as the industry will accept. And we were looking at residues that encompass the entire spectrum of polarity. So we were looking at both the in-hive, very lipophilic chemicals, to that of the most water-soluble pesticides. And to do this required coming to a compromise between the laboratory, which turns out to be the USDA AMS laboratory, and that of what was practical. But we wanted to look at the systemic compounds such as seed treatments because of their literature in regards to the European problem, and which turns out to be our problem too, perhaps. But and as well as we wanted to take a look at the sorts of chemicals that you can detect in a way that would be found in the wax of the beehives, so the in-hive chemicals. And this was a compromise between looking at detections in milk and as well as apple with seed treatments and in-hive chemicals to come up with a list of 171 pesticide active ingredients we were looking at. And we want to detect these at parts per billion levels. Well, this is a rather comprehensive approach, but at the same time, we found this laboratory. The laboratory was actually operated by an apius. The chemist was an apius. So we had his heart in regards to the problem. And so we dealt with both the trapped and pollen as well as the bee bread within the hive. We wanted to also take a look at the wax and then went to matrices that include the brood and the nectar and the adult bees and the royal jelly, and then as well as wanted to also take a look at the multitude of samples that are being generated by the colony collapse group, which included hundreds of samples from seven different states. So there's a lot of business on this slide, but I just want to point out the fact that in order to have an identity relative to pesticide using a good laboratory practice in regards to a laboratory of this type requires using sophisticated instrumentation. We want to use a very efficient method. The method that turns out to be most useful was that of the catchers, which is taking your sample, squashing it up with solid absorbents as well as drying agents to get a very efficient movement of the chemicals into an acetonitrile or appropriate solvent. And then to use liquid chromatography in tandem with mass spectroscopy in a way, as well as GCMS, to quantitate both the involatile and the volatile chemicals respectively. Most of your systemics don't go through a GC, so you need to use both instrumentations. But in order to do this, this sort of analysis gives you a compounds that when you're trying to deal with finding or detecting a chemical at a certain retention time in a chromatogram, you need to know that the identity is dependent on the retention time of the chemical being precise, the mass that is associated with that, retention time being precise, and that the chemical fragments at least two transitions that are at the right rate ratio in order to be considered as a detection. So in the case of imidacloprid, you can see that there's two different fragmentations that are followed. The mass is 256. The one fragmentation goes to 175, which lops off a chlorine and a nitro group. And then another transition goes through 209, which is in relative to the nitro group just coming off. And unless those two transitions are satisfied, the detection is not going to be considered. So each chemical, each detection has to have all these criteria in order to be recognized. So with this, and among the 43 pesticides that we identified in our samples, just the pollen samples to date, that includes 92 samples, there were three in red at the top that were above or prevalent in the samples above the 50%. So most of the samples had fumafos, most of the samples had chlorpyrifos, most of the samples had fluvalinate, and these are the detections that were found at least in 10% of the pollen samples. So here, the pyrethroids then are dominating, organophosphates are dominating, the endosulfan is a cyclodine insecticide that's found environmentally in lots of different matrices, but still being found a lot in the pollen samples. Chlorpyrifos is the organophosphate that is the a typical environmental chemical that's no longer used readily, but it still has some leftovers. And there's also, you can see there's lots of herbicides and fungicides, and we found seven different classes of insecticides within these samples. If we look at the highest residues that we found to date in the pollen, captan, which is a fungicide, was found at 10 parts per million in one sample, which skewed it a bit away from, there's a mean level here of 1.3 parts per million. But among the chemicals that are found at 50 parts per billion or above 50 parts per billion, you can see there's a number of neonicotinoids, thioclopride and acetamiprid, were found in samples, not frequently, but found in samples at above 50 parts per billion on a mean. Chlorpyrifos, and then going up the spectrum, there was an IGR, difluobenzuron, which is an insect chitin synthesis inhibitor. But the most prevalent samples or chemicals were, again, fluvalinate, cumafos, and among the frequent samples. But surprisingly, a carbamate, aldicarb, was found in some of the samples at high levels, and the fungicides such as chlorothalonil, which is sometimes put in paint, which might be used around a hive, was also prevalent. So again, a lot of different chemicals, and the levels here are somewhat unprecedented for pollen samples. These are very high levels. So you're ranging to 6 parts per million cumafos in the samples. You're ranging up to 3 parts per million fluvalinate in these pollen samples. And again, up to 1.1, these are violations, of course, of autocarbon pollen. So what does this have to do with the toxicity of the chemistry? Well, Sarah Ashcraft has worked out a bioassay scheme. We can put 10 bees into a cage of this sort, which is primarily disposable. There's 10 bees can be either orally or topically exposed to the chemicals, providing an artificial nectar source. The humidity can be controlled. You can get a whole bunch of chambers together and do a bunch of assays. But we're just checking out what is already, there's some questions about the toxicology, or we're looking at interactions in these bioassays. There's a lot of literature already that's been generated that allows you to have LD50 values for most of the chemistry that we're using. And these are, if we look at the most toxic of the chemicals, the 17 most prevalent or toxic chemicals within the pollen samples, well, about half of those, 8 of them, were pyrethroids. There's a again, chlorpyrifos and fluvalinate among that group, or chlorpyrifos is the organophosphate, but again, the only neonicotinoid detection, imidacloprid, among the prevalent 17 was found in 7 of the samples at a level that would be considered to be a problem relative to what is known from the French studies in regards to sublethal effects, but relative to its frequency, again, it's not a prevalent sort of chemical within the samples that we've generated or looked at so far. So, in looking at just what has been done to date with pollen, we've seen up to 17 different pesticides per sample. On the average, it's 5. Only 3 of the samples lacked any detections whatsoever. And among these 43 different pesticides, there's also 5 other metabolites, 8 pyrethroids, 4 organophosphates, 4 carbamates, 3 neonicotinoids, 2 insect growth regulators, then a couple organochlorines and endosulfan. But there's also a lot of fungicides, and 13 different fungicides and 6 herbicides, but their levels are not as, well, the herbicides aren't considered at this point to be a problem, but the fungicides might be an issue. Now, at least 14 of these chemicals are systemic. In bee health, though, when we took a look at what we had relative to pollen and tried to associate it with the colony collapse snapshot view that Dennis already mentioned in regards to the health of the colony at the sampling, looking at, was the score of 4 was dead, 3 dwindling, 2 recovering, and 1 strong. There wasn't a really strong correlation between fluvalinate as a major player in the samples in regards to the bee health. Now, there could be different reasons for this. One is that it's a snapshot look. The other is that it's only looking at the pollen residues. So what about other matrices? And if we take it to the wax and take a look at what's going on in wax, then there's even more of a problem in regards to total amounts of chemical that were found. With fluvalinate, and this is still, we're only looking at a small set of the samples to date, but out of the first 18 samples that we sent to the facility, all of them had fluvalinate, all of them had Coumaphos. Coumaphos oxone is the primary active, it's the chemical that Coumaphos has to be metabolized to be active on insect at the target site, acetylcholinesterase. Those were in all the samples. Chlorpyrifos was basically in all the samples at lower levels. And the fungicide, surprisingly, this chlorothalonil showed up in the wax at fairly high frequency too. But you go down through that list, you have some odd fungicides. You have a number of miticides like dicofol, also that could be associated with bees. There's an IGR methoxyphenicide that's present, and as well as some malathion. But again, it's the in-hive chemicals, as well as chlorpyrifos and endosulfan, for example, as environmental prototypes that are prevalent in the wax. These levels for field samples in beeswax are not good. They're as high as a lot of the literature has for relative to experiments in the laboratory. So 34 parts per million, or 17 parts per million Coumaphos, the fluvalinate as high as ever been detected in wax in regards to field samples. If we look at other matrices, and this is very, we're still just getting into this analysis, but and if you look at some of the in-hive matrices, brood, wax, and pollen relative to the hive that is controlled or strong or dwindling or dead in an operation, there's some tendency to increase the chemical residues relative to increasing toxicity. But for the most part, there's a fairly, the correlation is not strong. So while in some operations there is this tendency, others, their variability is a lot greater. And so right at this point, we cannot say with any definitive resolution on it that what's happening as far as pesticide residues is the only story. But again, this is a snapshot of the bee health, and also the big problem is you're really looking at the leftovers in the samples. It's what's left over in the hive that actually is being measured in the samples and in the analysis. So we need to take all this back into the lab and get a better view of it by trying to look at what is actually interacting with the pesticides in regards to the other stress factors. The comic strips have pretty well advertised a lot about the colony collapse disorder. And if the bee situation is anything like the human situation, it's really just too many different stresses going on, too many players, and certainly pesticides is one of the players, but we need to also take a look at the other factors. It's a busy slide, but the other thing I want to point out is that even with fluvalinate, it's not clear. The toxicology known for fluvalinate alone is very kind of mixed in the literature. If you go through the background with this chemical, it was first noted to be a non-toxic chemical, LD50 of 65.8 micrograms per bee, by Atkins way back in the early 70s. But as it went from company to company, Zoecon, Sandoz, and Wellmark, and then relative to its use, there was an improvement in the synthesis of the compound, so it made it increase the toxicity at least twice by taking out some of the inactive isomers. But even with that, the LD50s, if we go to the to 1992, the same laboratory was publishing a number of 8.8 micrograms per bee for fluvalinate LD50, even when there's the toxicity hasn't really markedly been changed or shifted. Now, when EPA was re-registering this compound in 2005, they generated data that suggested that the LD50 is more in line with the other pyrethroids of 0.2 micrograms per bee. So it went from being relatively non-toxic to a moderately toxic to a highly toxic chemical by EPA's definition for toxicity for honeybees. So this is one factor. The other is that as you were generating resistance in a hive to these chemicals in Europe and then as well as in the U.S., and then realized that really the first formulation, Maverick, was used first, and then Apistan.